Nick Lowe, performer, producer, writer with pen in hand and tongue not too far from cheek. Sometimes called the father of new wave, but with a certain strange affinity for acoustic guitars. Following the early success of his latest album, Nick the Knife, and opening for the Cars on their current tour, Nick stopped by NEWFM recently. When you set about to record the new album, with any particular ideas that you wanted to accomplish with this record? Any changes from past works that you've done?
No, I didn't really. Because this new album, it didn't actually take me long to record. I mean, if you actually added up the amount of actual studio time, it'd probably come to about 2 or 3 weeks or something like that. But I did it over a long period of time. I probably even started doing it really when Rock Pile was still going. You know, that I did it in odd afternoons and evenings and things like that. So really, there was quite a lack of continuity about the whole thing. I just recorded a song whenever I had one, and then someone said, "Well, you can stop now. I think you've got enough for an album." What most other people have said is that they notice that it's kind of more conventional. It's more sort of straighter, really.
I've read things where people say that your sense of humor seems to have been put aside in this record. I don't particularly find that at all. I think there are a number of things on there where the Nick Lowe sense of humor is as strong as ever. Stick It Where the Sun Don't Shine is a prime example of that.
I didn't consciously do anything, you know, think, oh, I better just, you know, get my act together. It just seemed that the way that the songs came out, you know, they were a bit more... That there can be something a bit cloying about that after a while, you know. It can be a bit, I don't know if you know the word twee, you know, but, you know, if you, it means sort of cute, like, oh, sort of a bit sickly cute, you know. If you kind of force that, I think anything forced is bad news in any case. You know, if you force out and say, well, everyone expects me to write these sort of quirky little songs, you know. What generally happens, in fact, is I start off by writing a song, thinking, you know, or I'd like to do a real soul song, like a Clarence Carter type thing or something like that. And I start off with the best intention in the world of doing a sort of serious type soul song or a blues song or rock and roll style song, but just the way it comes out, you know, I start sort of fiddling around with the words and things like that, and they generally turn out slightly different. But I start out with the intention, you know, of writing a sort of serious attempt.
So Stick It Where the Sun Don't Shine was actually a very serious song when you
sat
down to write it?
No, I heard that, actually I heard that on the Tom Schneider Show, of all places. I was watching the Tom Schneider Show with, you know, half an ear and half an eye, as usual, but they had a bloke on. He was the guy from Chicago, disc jockey from Chicago, who started the Death to Disco movement.
Oh, Dahl. Steve Dahl.
That's it. And he was on, and he said, he was talking away, and I was quite getting off on him, and I was just pottering around the old hotel room, and he said, well, anyway, Tom, if you don't like that, you can just stick it where the sun don't shine. And I fell on the floor. I thought that was so funny. I understand it's quite a well-known expression over here, but I'd never heard it before, and it just, I started thinking, boy, that sounds such a great expression. You could actually write quite a rocking song to that. And I started thinking, stick it.
You can call up the law as soon.
How does Nick Lowe the producer affect Nick Lowe the artist?
Well, I find it much easier to produce other people really than I do my own stuff, because I'm like a lot of other people in this business, really quite lazy, and with other people I can sort of live out, when I'm producing other people or writing songs for other people, which I find much easier than writing songs for myself, I find I can sort of live out my fantasies, for want of a better expression, through them. In other words, especially if they're really good singers, I can sort of say, well, why don't you sing this phrasing, or why don't you try that phrasing out? In other words, the sort of phrasing that I can hear in my own head, and which I would do had I got as good a voice, you know, for instance, as the person that I'm producing. Sometimes they tell me to shut up, you know, but nonetheless, it's quite good fun to try, especially if it works out, you know, if they try something which they wouldn't necessarily have done. I mean, I have quite a lot of trouble with my own voice, because, like, I'm sure, you know, lots of people listening as well will have heard themselves talking on a cassette player or tape recorded somehow, and, you know, you're always so shocked when you first hear your voice, because it doesn't sound anything like...
It can't be me.
Yeah, it doesn't sound anything like it sounds like when it's reverberating around your head. But when you sing, it's even worse, you know, especially when you're in the studio and you can pull out all the other tracks, so you just hear this one voice sort of with all these terrible inflections, and you can hear these little wobbles and things you've been trying on. It's really embarrassing, but you have to just forget that it's a human voice, you know, and especially your human voice, and just sort of treat it as a piano or a guitar, just an instrument, you know, and you have to twiddle knobs to get it, you know, put EQ on it, you know, get it more tonally nice. So I tend to sort of get the singing part of my own records out of the way as soon as possible. So with other people, it's, when I'm producing other people, I find it far easier.
You have brought, at least to my mind, a renewed interest in the acoustic guitar as a rock and roll instrument. Is that by design?
Oh, great. Oh, yes. Yes, it is absolutely by design. What a great thing to say, yeah. Oh, I'm mad for acoustic. Yes, because for so long they've been this great sort of wimpy mush. You know, they just... 5 more acoustic guitars, quick, pass them down. Whereas, in fact, the acoustic guitar, the Everlys and Eddie Cochran, they used to use them, and they sounded like electrics, and they just banged through with the drums. I like them played like that. Great big heavy old strings on them, and give them a damn good thrashing. That's what they deserve. Instead of stroking them like a bloody...
That's wimp. Cruel to be kind for you.
Mm-hmm.
The fullness that you get with a 6-string acoustic guitar is just amazing. It's so bright and resonant.
Oh, good. Fantastic. I shall continue to do it then.
See,
case.
Another thing works. Well, I want to thank you for stopping by. It's certainly been a real pleasure to talk to you.
My pleasure indeed as well. Thank you for asking me.
On and off the rock and roll road with Nick Lowe. And next time you're on the road and run out of gas, keep your wits about you. Stacey Kahn tells us there's a wave of piracy at the pumps. Oil industry analyst Dan Lundberg has predicted that the price of gas will drop by as much as 19 cents a gallon by year's end. But just because prices are low and supplies are high doesn't mean you don't risk dropping money at the gas pump. Ken Rosenblum is the Commissioner of Consumer Affairs in Suffolk County, Long Island, and he says when you fill her up, make sure the pump has been reset to zero.
Put yourself in a situation, it's 11 o'clock at night, 1 o'clock in the morning, you just pull off a parkway, and you come up to the pump, and the attendant says, would you pull up to the end of the island, please?
And naturally you do. But why, when no one's around?
Very often the reason that you're asked to pull to the end of the island is so that you can't see the pump.
Then you don't know for sure what you're paying for, and Rosenblum says there are other things you should be aware of.
Once you've got yourself in a position where you can see both the beginning and ending numbers on the gas pump and make sure that the numbers read all zeros, the next thing that you should check is the pump sign and the pump price.
Rosenblum says that every gas pump in New York State must have a large sign posted over it telling the price per gallon in dollars and cents. Check to make sure the price on the sign matches the price that's on the pump itself. And also make sure there's glass covering the dials on the pump.
If you pull up to a pump and there's no glass in front of those little numbers, just drive right on. Because if there's no glass on those little numbers, busy little fingers can get in there and change the dials and you'll be charged more than you're going to be paying for.
And if you carry plastic, take a close look at how those credit card vouchers are being filled out.
There's two numbers on it. There's a machine-printed number in the upper right-hand corner, and there's a pen and ink written-in number in the lower right-hand corner.
Make sure both dollar amounts match. It's the computerized number that figures into your monthly bill. All these things to look out for, but not every gas station is out there to rip you off.
What I discuss tends to be kind of a composite of all the horrible things that we've seen happen. It doesn't mean it's going to happen to everyone every day, but everything that I've discussed is a ripoff that we've got no complaint about and that we've confirmed.
Ken Rosenblum, Commissioner of Consumer Affairs in Suffolk County. I'm Stacey Kahn. Seems crime isn't something that's happening to someone else. It's happening to you and to your friends. It's suggested we've become a society of victims, afraid to walk the streets, take the subways, leave the windows and doors unbarred.
People call us after these events, not frequently immediately after, but several days or several weeks after, feeling that they're really very scared to go out, that this is thoroughly disrupted their lifestyle, their comfort, their sense of security in the city.
Alan Menikoff of New York City's Victim Services Agency.
And we'll call and sometimes describe in detail what happened. And our impression is that it was, as I said before, a truly, if you want to call it, gratuitous violence.
I was very angry. That was my first reaction, was very angry. And the thing that came after that was the feeling of being totally helpless. If somebody wants to take advantage of you, that's what they're going to do.
Victims speak of a loss of innocence, of self-esteem, of personal freedom. A group of Girl Scouts, the oldest 11, enroll in a self-defense class. One of them was raped on her way home from school. The city's tabloids, each not to be outdone, are commending crime fighters and crime busters. And an Israeli firm, suppliers to the Israeli army, offers a line of bulletproof fashion wear. Protection, they say, for anyone who needs or wants it.
The city set all-time records for crime in 1980 and exceeded those records in 1981. Since we have five or six times more violent crime today than we had 20 years ago, we obviously don't feel too well about it. I said, he set all-time records for crime in 1980 and exceeded those records in 1981. Since we have five or six times more violent crime today than we had 20 years ago, we obviously don't feel too well about it.
Tom Repetto, president of the Citizens Crime Commission.
But I think everybody shares that. You know, there was a survey done just a few months ago, and New Yorkers placed crime as the number one problem facing the city. Half the people said it was the number one problem. The next highest was unemployment, cited by 10%. So you can see how important crime is, much more important than employment or taxes or whatever. So something has to be done about it, and soon.
The Crime Commission is a watchdog agency, a nonprofit research group monitoring crime and crime prevention in New York City. Repetto is a former Chicago cop who holds a doctorate from Harvard, where he studied criminal justice.
The criminal justice system in New York City and New York State, because the state system also affects the city, really ceased to function well about 15 years ago. In part, this was because they were swamped with cases, and it's in part because the system changed some of its philosophy. For example, it no longer became fashionable to award prison sentences. There was a sharp decline in the prison population in New York State. More importantly, it no longer was fashionable for judges and other key officials to say no when people behaved in very strange, bizarre, even very seriously criminal ways. Remember, it wasn't too long ago that graffiti was considered to be an expression of art. Now the people of New York City do not feel that way anymore, and the criminal justice system is beginning to respond to the public attitude.
But has it responded soon enough? Mayor Koch, speaking to a group of newly graduated transit cops, called the city a fortress besieged by criminals.
A lot of people can't enjoy the streets, the parks. A lot of people hesitate to use the subway. I dare say most New Yorkers have to make some decision every day to at least consider foregoing. Maybe it's a simple thing like a subway ride, because it might be too dangerous. So in that respect, we are living in a fortress. Obviously, more true for some than others, that we live in a society where young girls have to train in the martial arts, not because they like the martial arts as a sport, but because they're afraid to go down the street.
She's not a girl who misses much. Oh yeah. She's well acquainted with the touch of the velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane. The man in the crowd with the multicolored mirrors on his hobnail boots, lying with his eyes while his hands are busy working overtime. A soap impression of his wife, which he ate and donated to the National Trust.
Friedman is executive director of the Victim Services Agency, an ombudsman group intervening for the rights of victims in a society that's almost all too willing to add insult to injury. Last year, Victim Services aided more than 60,000 New Yorkers, helping with everything from muggings to car theft to murders.
I think what we see is we're getting more increasing numbers of calls in the domestic violence area, in the elderly abuse area, although still I'm sure we're not getting nearly what's out there. The numbers are going up. And more also of families, of people sort of recognizing it's not only the victim but the family that needs it. But in terms of sort of the major crimes like robbery and burglary, I haven't seen any distinct patterns.
With 7 community offices fueled with city, state, federal, and private funding, the agency has been helping crime victims since 1978 when it was created by Mayor Koch. The major point of the agency's outreach is its 24-hour hotline. Not only are calls on the increase, hotline director Alan Menikoff says the crimes callers are phoning in are increasingly more violent.
Where you would have someone whose pocketbook or gold chain or something was stolen, was ripped off, and it would seem that it could have been done just like that, you know, taken without violence done to the person. Sort of gratuitous violence was added on to the theft of property, that sort of thing.
We would seem to have reached that world without center, but those most directly involved believe they have answers. For Tom Repetto, it means increased jail space, more cops on the street, a speed up in the jury selection process to prevent court backup, and bail reform. Additionally, Repetto applauds a recently instituted watch on known career criminals, a program he says has resulted in a sizable number of arrests.
I am not one of these people who says there's nothing can be done. Move out, hide, lock behind the doors, get under the bed. I think that people working together can find solutions to these problems.
In many communities, it means block associations, some groups going so far as to hire their own security to make sure they get the protection they want.
Another area that we are getting involved in is with the police is channeling some of the energy that people sort of get sparked by being a victim into, I hope, crime prevention activities. I think one of the things that happens when you're a crime victim is you become more fearful, sometimes you become angry, and I'd like to channel that into something constructive, and a lot of people want to sort of take control again. And one of the things that happens when you're a victim is you feel out of control, you feel powerless.
Police officer Vincent Lupinacci is the auxiliary police coordinator for New York's 20th precinct.
They do get involved and they spot something going down, a violation of serious consequence. They have the walkie-talkie, instant communication with either I here at the station house or 911. And our records show many of a great deal of arrests, intelligent acts have been done by auxiliary police officers. You and your neighbor picking up the gauntlet, as they would say, and saying, hey, I can do something. I can get involved.
This is the feeling on which the movies Death Wish and Death Wish 2 capitalize. Death Wish was set in New York, Death Wish 2 in Los Angeles. The stories are basically the same. A man's family is victimized. He gets no satisfaction, no redress from society. He takes the law into his own hands. He becomes a vigilante. Death Wish 2 is one of the biggest grossing movies in this country. When I saw the film, there were some titters in the audience. Death Wish 2 certainly isn't a work of art. It's not even a good movie. But of the people who saw it the day I did, there wasn't one I spoke with who didn't applaud the film's eye for an eye message.
I'm not sure there aren't people doing that. I mean, we've had in Georgia where they've passed the law that everybody's required to have a gun to protect their household. And I'm sure that a lot of people are in their own way, you know, in their own home, consider it their own territory and take the same kind of tactics.
He was right about that, you know. I would do the same thing in a way, you know.
It was interesting how he took revenge on his wife and his daughter.
Think he was right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you've been a victim of a crime, I can understand it, you know. I've been a victim of a crime, and I can understand the feeling, wanting to do it, and the anger that, you know, forces you to do it, really. You look at the movie, and you know exactly the feelings that the people are feeling, and you know exactly the feeling that the vigilante is feeling. And whether or not you can say it's right, it's great that he makes the crime rate come down, okay? But at the same time, he's hurting inside, and he needs help too.
I like the idea. Like, it's something you have to do.
I feel the same as he did. If that was my daughter, I want to kill too.
That about does it for this week. Thanks for joining us on FM, and thanks for your response to our first show. We'd like you to let us know what you're thinking about what we're doing. We're at FM, care of NEWFM, 655 3rd Avenue, New York, New York, 10017. Production assistance for FM by Richard Neer. I'm Robin Sagan. See you in 2 weeks. We're WNEWFM, New York.